Welcome and breathe in air. Abstract Illusions Radio, the show that explores and exposes the many aspects of expression, with your host, Jennifer Hellman. Good evening, everyone. This is Jennifer Hellman, and I thank you very much for joining me on air. Tonight's guest is world-renowned in his area. Dr. Rumen Newman is a doctor of, he is a clinical psychologist who specializes in behavioral sleep and dream medicine. He is a sleep specialist that is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Arizona Center of Integrative Medicine. Thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
You have a wonderful new CD set, which is The Yoga of Sleep, where you kind of bridge modern medicine with the world wisdom traditions. What inspired you to do this?
Well, frankly, I've always had a deep interest in spiritual aspects of consciousness, and specifically sleep and dreams. And I am, by training and in terms of my work, I'm a clinician, I'm a clinical psychologist, and a professor, and a scientist foremost. And so I think I've always couched the sacred aspects of sleep in the frame of science. Last year, Sounds True approached me and offered me an opportunity, in one sense, to come out of the closet, which I'm very excited about doing as somebody who really looks at sleep issues, the larger context of sleep issues, in terms of sacredness and spirituality and consciousness. So I was really delighted to have a chance to reframe my work in this broader context.
So with the higher consciousness and spiritualization, do you feel that sleep and dreaming is really an essence meditation in some form?
Well, I think maybe it's the other way around, maybe we would say most meditation techniques direct us, the practices take us into a deeper kind of consciousness, which gets closer and closer to and eventually overlaps with sleep consciousness. You know, the larger issue, I think, is that in our world today, first of all, we're dealing with epidemic sleep disorders. The numbers are astounding. You know, conservatively, somewhere between 40 and 70 million American adults have clinical sleep disorders. It's a humongous issue. And that's why, as I said, it's a conservative figure. And our efforts to try to ameliorate that, I think, are falling flat. We see new sleeping pills coming out every few months. We see new techniques, new promises, and so on. And I think the reason we're really not able to get a handle on managing this sleeplessness epidemic is we really don't get sleep. We really don't understand sleep. We keep trying to frame sleep strictly in scientific terms. And I want to clarify, I'm not arguing at all against the science. I think it's essential. It's necessary. It's just insufficient. And so the question of what sleep is, the scientific perspective on that, the answer to that question is really similar to the cultural perspective. If you ask most people, you know, really what is sleep, they'll define it essentially as not being awake. So it's a negative definition. It doesn't tell you what sleep is. It tells you what sleep is not compared to waking. And it reveals a very fundamental bias in our understanding of sleep and dreams. And this is the bias. We look at sleep as a servant of waking life. In fact, virtually all scientific research asks variations on the theme of the same question. The scientific research asks, how can you, sleep, help us be healthier, help us improve our performance and improve our memory and improve our appearance and improve our immunity and prevent accidents and on and on and on. And these are very valid questions, but all the questions assume that sleeping simply is a servant or is subservient to waking. We have a waking consciousness bias, a prejudice in our world. We assume the waking, what we're doing right now, is it, that this is the gold standard for consciousness. And again, it's a very significant bias that doesn't allow us to see sleep independently of waking. So the spiritual perspective, I think, breaks that frame open. It's not in contrast to what science teaches us about sleep or how to heal sleep, but it expands it. It teaches us that sleep is not simply a servant of waking. Sleep is also an end in and of itself.
And with that, so it serves a purpose of really, to me, meditation and sleep is very sacred to me. Mm-hmm. So how do you think we can change, or what is your perception of the ways you're trying to change society's view on sleep then?
Well, I think we need to stop looking at it. You know, we often look at many things in life that are sacred as being functional. And they are functional. Meditation is a good example. Meditation can help lower blood pressure, improve immunity, reduce anxiety, manage stress. It can be very helpful in managing pain, and on and on. So meditation is functional, but that's not all it is. It also is a portal. It's a path that takes us someplace else. We do this with food and nutrition nowadays. You know, food is wonderful. It's a joy to eat. But for many people, it's become strictly a function. You know, it's like, let's see, I need to get some salmon because I haven't had my omega-3s in the last few days.
Right.
I'm not arguing against the function of things like meditation and eating and exercise is another example. I'm just saying that we can't, if we limit our perspective on these kinds of essential life activities to being functional, we lose the beauty of them. We lose the sacredness. We can meditate and eat and sleep primarily for the joy of that experience, not simply as something that would make our waking lives better. So the implication is there's something else in sleep. There is something else there. From a waking world perspective, from a scientific perspective, we say that sleep is nothing. It's not waking. And because we believe that waking is everything in terms of consciousness, we say that sleep is nothing. And in the Western world, you know, the notion of nothing is meaningless. It's worthless.
Mm-hmm.
In the East, of course, and this is where the concept of yoga of sleep becomes very important, nothingness is sacred. There's a recognition that the lack of thingness, the lack of form, holds something quite essential in and of itself. And I think sleep takes us there. I think of sleep as the lazy person's guide to enlightenment. I think, frankly, if we're willing, sleep will deliver us to a much deeper sense of awareness, a much deeper sense of serenity.
I definitely agree with you, especially since the dreamscape is really a very powerful element that can heal. It can open your mind to so many different dimensions, different areas of your life. It can help you solve problems. It's just interesting that the brain overall, and correct me if I'm wrong, during REM sleep is more active than it really is when we're awake. Is that true?
Well, yes and no. It's active in a different way. You know, what's interesting about dreaming, waking consciousness, my belief, and I think a number of people share this, is that waking and dreaming are essentially the same kind of consciousness. In waking life, we are dreaming, but the dream experience is framed and constrained by sensory input. So right now, I'm sitting at my desk. I'll admit my feet are up on my desk. I'm looking out a French door in the window and looking out at some beautiful blossoming flowers outside my window. And So that's sensory input, and I'm listening to you, and I'm listening to myself, and I'm looking around. So there's visual and auditory. So all of that really defines my consciousness right now. Waking is the dream that is defined, limited, constrained by sensory input. Dreaming is a dream that is not limited or confined or structured by sensory input. So all of this information that comes into our being during the day is not there when we close our eyes, go to sleep, and then shift into dreaming. So we experience consciousness in an unframed fashion in the dream, but the two are very much connected.
Okay, so explain how they're connected then.
Well, I think they're the same. I think there's a continuum. One of the things I talk about in my work is something called the United States of Consciousness. And most people who study consciousness would agree that there are basically three kinds of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's waking, sleeping, and dreaming. And the presumption in our world is that they're discrete and somewhat segregated. We see this in sleep signs, for example. When we measure sleep at night, we'll designate that somebody is awake, and then suddenly we'll say then suddenly they're asleep, and then suddenly they're dreaming, and then they're awake or sleeping, dreaming, they're in and out. The truth is, when you look closely at it, the boundaries between or among these three states of consciousness are not discrete. You know, we like to think that we're either awake or asleep, but the deeper truth is that in any given moment, we are to varying degrees or awake or asleep. If we're mm-hmm. wide awake, there might just be, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5% of sleepiness in the background. If we're deep in sleep, there might be that small percent of wakefulness in the background. But these states of consciousness overlap. I think of them as like a braid of hair, where the three strands make up our being. And our tendency to segregate and separate, to see waking life, for example, as being devoid of the dream, and to see sleep as being devoid of any awareness or waking, these are big mistakes we make. During waking life, if we see the dream as being separate, we cut ourselves off from our creativity. There are dreamlike aspects of waking consciousness that we can allow in. Even in sleep, if we assume that any awareness contradicts sleep, we'll spin off into anxiety. And by the way, accomplished meditators often have spontaneous awareness during sleep. You know, we think that being asleep means you're unconscious. And for most of us, that's true because we haven't developed the skill to, in a sense, metaphorically, to open our eyes under the water of sleep. But accomplished meditators can do that. There are examples of people who are able to sit and enter brainwave activity that is comparable to deep sleep with their eyes open. So they're in both worlds. The point here, again, is that we need to consider that there's a unified consciousness. There's a oneness to who we are. And we experience that more directly when we allow aspects of sleeping and dreaming to weave together with waking.
And do you feel that with the way that the world is going, that we're constantly going, do you feel that there's a chance that people are going to, in a way, wake up to that they need the sleep? Or do you think that just because of the way society is pressuring people, they're just going to say, I got to go. I know what you're saying, but I've got too much to do to really understand
this
the
is a fundamental spiritual question. You know, again, a lot of people will use spirituality in a functional way. It becomes one more thing on their list. You know, mm-hmm. because they know that if they have a spiritual practice, it'll help them manage their stress. Once again, it'll reduce their blood pressure. It'll have all kinds of good impacts on their psychological, their social, their biological health. And again, that's fine. But, you know, spirituality is not something we necessarily use to impact this world. It's something that expands our awareness into another world. So I think that's the crux there is that there's a question of what we want, and do we primarily want to find ways of better manipulating manipulating our waking world, or do we want to make a connection with the world that takes us beyond the ordinary, mundane rat race of waking life?
So what are some of the tips that you would give if somebody does want to tip that scale and get an expansive view, in a sense, of life?
Well, I think the first step in that is really turning inward and examining the question of what we really want. So I think a lot of us have learned and unconsciously practice the belief, or base practices on the belief, that if we get waking life right, if we do it just right, you know, it's going to bring us happiness and spiritual awareness. And I don't believe that there's any strong correlation between being successful in the waking world or being healthy in the waking world, you know, or having, you know, a good marriage or a nice car, any of that. I don't know that any of that directly correlates with spirituality. It may for some people, it may not. So I think there's that question of where we fundamentally aim. You know, Carl Jung wrote about a shift that happens for many people, or potential shift later in life, where, you know, when we've spent a couple of decades working the world and we get, you know, varying degrees of success, and we get an understanding of what it does offer and what it does not offer us, there can be a shift in midlife toward a much deeper commitment to a personal spirituality. So I think that's a first step. When it comes to sleep, what I found interesting when I began this work, you know, a few decades ago, was that all the parallels between the techniques for good sleep and techniques or practices for a good spiritual life. You know, one of the examples is in sort of generically in the practice of yoga, there's a tremendous emphasis on learning to let go. Mm-hmm. You know, just letting go, whether it's letting go of, you know, tightness in a muscle, letting go of a particular emotion, letting go of a thought, you know, observing mindfully and letting go. And when it comes down to sleep, this process of letting go is probably the most essential technique that's been forgotten. Very consistent, again, with yogic philosophies across the board. So a lot of people, for example, unconscious, because we're so attached to waking life, we unconsciously import waking ways of being into the world of sleep. And this is a very obvious thing. You know, one example is when night falls, most of us extend daytime, which is the medium of waking life, into the night. We turn on lights, we turn on our computers, our TV sets, and we just keep going as if it's part of the waking, productive day. You know, the National Sleep Foundation a couple of years ago found that a small but significant number of Americans routinely sleep in their clothes. I was fascinated by this. You know, most of us listen to that and we go, wow, that's really kind of strange. But, you know, the deeper truth is that the vast majority of us sleep in our psychological garb. Mm-hmm. Most of us know to change our clothes and to transition physically into night with cleansing rituals and so on. But most of us don't know that we need to change our minds as well as our clothes. We walk into the night, we get into bed with the same waking frame of mind that we use during the day. It's a little bit like trying to understand night and darkness by using a flashlight. We smuggle waking ways of being in the world. Now, waking consciousness is defined primarily by intention. You know, right now, as we're awake and talking and listening, we all have varying levels of intention within us. There are things that we want. And so an intention determines our perception. Perception, of course, determines the world we live in. In contrast to waking consciousness being informed and defined by intention, night consciousness, this sleep and dream consciousness, is really defined primarily by reception. If waking is yang, in the Taoist, you know, Chinese medicine perspective, then of course night consciousness, sleep and dreams are much more yin. And we, you know, most of us bring that yang, that active consciousness, consciousness into the night. And here's how it translates. People get into bed and then they, quote, go to sleep. There's an interesting
right.
notion. Most of us will commonly think and sometimes say this at night, like, I'm going to sleep. It's like, watch this trick. Well, the truth is that the I in waking consciousness that wants to do things, that's intentional, cannot go to sleep. What can I do? I can go to bed. I can turn out the lights. I can put my head on the pillow. I can pull the covers up. But you know what? That's all waking activity. We can't go to sleep. And this is the big problem that arises. People who have sleep problems, you know, insomnia and sleeplessness, often try really hard and sometimes in very sophisticated, tricky manners to get themselves to sleep. Any effort they devote to trying to get to sleep keeps them tethered to waking consciousness. So once again, there's nothing that we can actually do to go to sleep. The deeper realization here is we can't go to sleep because we are already asleep. Now, this is confusing to many people, but this is the truth as I see it. Sleep is the default consciousness. Sleep exists in the background always. Just as the sun is up in the sky and it may be occluded by clouds every now and then, there's a part of us that is always already asleep. We never go to sleep. We simply reveal the sleep that's there. Sleep is serenity. It's the essential peace that's deep in our hearts. It's given. It's grace. It's already there. We can't go to sleep. What we can do is let go of waking. We can let go of waking. And then in that process, we can surrender to sleep.
So my question that popped in my head as you were saying that about sleep, and we're part of us when we're awake, and there's always that part of the sleepiness, that serenity. So in essence, isn't that kind of like the intuitiveness that is always present? Or am I seeing this in a kind of a weird way?
Well, when you say intuitiveness, you mean the part of us that just sort of knows?
That connection to another side. For me, I'm always connected to the other side. I can suddenly just, boom, I will have a vision, and it's very dreamlike, and it's very serene, and it's very much giving me information that is helpful.
Right. That is helpful in what sense?
In calming me down even more, resting that anxiety, making me realize that I am connected to the oneness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those terms, I would agree. I think that sleep is part of that bridge. It's part of that portal. It connects us. It takes us to a deeper place. And I think the more deeply we go, in deep sleep, you know, we go through various stages of sleep, but in what used to be called stage 3 and 4 is now called, collectively they're referred to as stage 3 or delta sleep or deep sleep. I think deep sleep takes us to our deep self. It takes, when I'm in that place, it takes me to the deepest part of me. And that's a part of me that doesn't necessarily carry my name or my waking world identity or consciousness. In the same sense that we look at statistics about divorce as being symptomatic of the disconnection between lovers, between partners or spouses, I look at insomnia as a divorce, as a symptom of divorce from self. When we have chronic struggles with sleep, we've disconnected chronically with the deeper parts of our own selves. So in that sense, again, it's a spiritual, sacred, yogic practice to become united with the deeper parts of ourselves. And it's a practice in trusting that part is reaching out to us, that, in a world where people work so hard, I think it's a challenge to understand that you don't really have to work at all to get to sleep, you know, that sleep is already given. If we keep running around looking for it, that activity obscures our connection with it. So to answer your question, yes, I do think they're really one and the same.
Okay. So in that sense, and there's different kinds of dreaming, correct?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, different levels. Okay, so let's, just for an example, when people are daydreaming, is that when they are connecting to that part of them that's asleep or that intuitiveness, or what is a daydream?
Daydreaming, in my work, we make a distinction between daydreaming and what we call the waking dream.
Okay.
Daydreaming for most people is simply an escape fantasy. You
okay.
might be sitting somewhere you don't want to be, if it's in traffic or a meeting or, you know, the dentist's waiting room, and your mind takes you to Hawaii, you know,
okay.
or someplace you'd really prefer to be. There's an escape quality to that, an escapist quality. And so that's daydreaming. That's very different than the waking dream. The waking dream probably is more aligned with what you were referring to a few minutes ago, the sense of connection with your own intuition. It's an
mm-hmm.
openness to the underground stream of consciousness. It unframes perception. And it's sort of listening to a softer, quieter, but palpable voice in yourself. It's tapping into the dream while you're awake. So that's the waking dream. And, you know, in my work, I say that we dream all the time. You know, we don't necessarily pay attention to it all the time, but it's there all the time. And we can become more open and receptive to it. I think consciously cultivating a connection with the dreaming part of us can help re-enchant our lives. And when I look around, you know, life today, so many people are just mired in the mundane. You know, they're just so caught up with endless, you know, often meaningless seeming details of life. And so in fact, I think of dreaming as a psychological yoga, in the sense that, you know, in yoga we stretch, and we become larger, more expansive than we thought we could at a physical level. We're talking about hatha yoga. I think psychologically dreaming is Mother Nature's yoga. It expands us. It stretches us. It keeps us from getting too constrained and congealed within ourselves. So, yeah, so there's the waking dream. And then there are different kinds of dreams at night as well. There are at least three different major kinds. There's a dream that's associated with the transition from waking into sleep. It's sometimes called a hypnagogic dream. And it's a dream that's sort of kaleidoscopic, in that images come and go. Really interesting images will appear and then they'll suddenly dissolve. There's kind of a breaking down of our hold of waking consciousness. So the bridge between waking and sleeping is the dream. And then there are dreams that occur early in the night. They tend to be shorter. I think of these dreams, and by the way, you know, dreaming from a functional standpoint is involved in the consolidation of memory. In dreams early in the night, there's kind of a sifting through the experiences we had that day. The mind kind of spins them by, it looks at them, it sort of chews, if you will, it chews on that experience, and it decides what it's going to swallow, what it's going to make part of itself, and what it's going to let go of. In the latter part of the night, where dreaming is longer, deeper, we have most of our dreams in the last third of the night, that material that was sifted in, that was gated in the early part of the night, then is assimilated, it's matched up into deeper parts of who we are, and it basically remakes us. We get reshaped and reformed and remade. The dreaming in that part of the night sort of, it digests and assimilates the new experiences that the psyche, that the mind has decided that it wants to keep, that it wants to incorporate into self.
So with these different, and for me, dreaming, I know that I have consciously healed situations through dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I go through the problem and I just say, okay, I need a solution. And it's like it gets worked out in the night. So the healing aspects of dreaming, do you feel that if somebody asks a question before they go to sleep, Do you agree that they can have a solution the next day?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what you're describing, Jennifer, is you have a faith in dreaming. You have a faith in deeper aspects of yourself. So you open your heart to that, and there's a kind of surrender. It's not like you're doing it. There's something beyond your identification, the I-ness, you know, who you are. You're trusting in something deeper. And I think that's what allows the healing to happen. And we might say it's a deeper part of ourselves or a part of the collective unconscious, but we tap into a broader truth. And I do think that. I think it's important to ask the right questions. And, I don't know that the dreamer inside of us is as concerned with waking life as we are. And I'm not trying to minimize the importance of waking life and waking consciousness, but in one sense, spiritually, the dreamer is much more of an executive function. And again, I think it can help with waking life, but it has a much broader perspective. And it's a little bit like if you have a spiritual teacher, you're not going to ask your spiritual teacher about, let's say, how to repair an electrical problem in your house. That's something that's mundane and you want to ask your electrician. You want to bring spiritually relevant questions to the dream and to the dreamer inside of you.
Yes, the thing that I was actually healing was the amount of anger that I was holding on inside, mm-hmm. and ways mm-hmm. to release that anger in some ways, because it wasn't serving me at right. all. And I really just wanted to lift it up and get it out of me, make peace with it in a way. I understand it is a part of me, but I don't have to live with it or actively use it. So that's the essence of what I was really using the healing part of
right.
it.
That's a great example. So that's much more of a spiritual quest.
Yeah. Yes. But I was looking at some YouTube videos, and they were saying, for example, there's been a few scientists, like Einstein, that would ask a question, this is a problem I've been working on, and he figured out quite a few of his situations just by sleeping. He also, mm-hmm. according to this YouTube, slept for 10 hours a night.
Yes, he did. Yeah. Well, there are numerous examples like that. Creativity. Paul McCartney talks about using dreams to create music. Watson and Crick, the whole image of the spiral in DNA came mm-hmm. in a dream. There are numerous examples like that. So yeah, I think dreaming. You know, once we have focused in on a question or a concern. And the trick here, again, is to trust and to have faith. We give it over to a deeper part of consciousness. It can help us immensely.
Yes. Now, where does lucid dreaming fall in this?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, there's a growing interest in lucid dreaming, and there's quite a bit of research now done. Stephen LeBerge at Stanford has done a lot of this work. But lucid dreaming has been around for eons.
Yes.
It's also a topic that's addressed by Tibetan sleep and dream yogas. And, in our world, well, first of all, most people have had some experience of lucidity. Most of us from time to time will be dreaming. Maybe we'd be in the middle of a nightmare, and suddenly, as we're dreaming with eyes closed, we realize, whoa, I'm in bed. And then there's this wave of relief that comes over us. It's like, oh my God, it's just a dream. And the dream is right there. Mm-hmm. As soon as we know that it's a dream, even if it's nightmarish, it becomes a lot more easy to tolerate, simply because we know it's just a dream and we're going to awaken from it. Now, a lot of lucidity, I think, there's a danger in trying to over-control. Because when you practice lucidity, you can actually enter your dreams and just make them go where you want. And in one sense, it's like again, smuggling waking world control, and we are in our world, we're taught to be control freaks, but it's taking that waking world consciousness, the control consciousness, into the dream, and, you know, we can make anything happen, we can fly, you know, we can have all the sex we want with anybody we want, we can eat what we want, we can do anything. I think that's a bit of a distraction. I think it takes a spiritual process, and it sort of refocuses it back down into the mundane. For me, I like the Tibetan perspective, which teaches lucidity but non-interference with the dream process. Let me give you an example of this. I was saying a minute ago that many people have the experience of, you know, starting to awaken, becoming lucid during a nightmare. And, you know, in many traditions, in many spiritual traditions, waking consciousness itself, and I hinted at this earlier, is considered a dream. You know, the whole notion that life is but a dream, or, you know, the notion of the veil in some traditions of Maya, the idea is that this experience of life itself is a dream. Well, I think one of the great benefits of dream work is learning, really, really coming to understand the dreamy dimensions of waking life. If we were to get, if we could truly understand that this waking life was a kind of dream, we would live with a sense, a palpable sense, of a pending greater awakening. Just as when we begin to awaken in the middle of a nightmare, you know, when we're sleeping at night, and that awareness, that lucidity, allows us to tolerate the nightmare as, oh yeah, okay, it's just simply because we know we're going to wake up. If we knew in our hearts for sure, in the same manner, that we would awaken from this dream of life, I think it would make the nightmarish aspects of this life a whole lot more tolerable. So practicing dream work in that sense has a very, I guess you could say, spiritual/practical, it can have an impact on our daily lives.
So by example, or by a situation, is there any way that people can really, I know you said they're not supposed to have control, but is there any way that people can amp up the amount of lucid dreaming that they're doing?
Yeah. Awareness is different than control, and I think, you know, cultivating expanded awareness, being more aware that we're dreaming or in dream. There are two basic places to do this. One is during waking, and one of the practices, and I've written about in different places, is to from time to time when you're awake, pretend that you're dreaming. So right now, if we were to just sort of relax our consciousness, even as we speak, and pretend that this is a dream, we begin to notice subtle but definite shifts in the quality of that consciousness. Because when we're dreaming, we notice different things. For example, if we're walking down the street, you're heading somewhere, you're late for a meeting or for work, you might walk down the sidewalk and notice a feather. Now, to the average person, it's just a feather. When I was a little boy growing up in New York, I was taught that they had germs and I shouldn't touch them because they were garbage. And, you know, it's just something that was dropped on the street. As part of waking life, it's not important. If you were walking down the street in a dream and you noticed a feather, my God, it's suddenly significant. Wow, there's a feather in my dream. What does that mean? In dreaming consciousness, there's a presumption of meaningfulness in everything. This is the world that children live in. In waking consciousness, there's a presumption that most things are meaningless unless they're aligned with my immediate intentions. So we can shift, even in waking life, we can move through life from moment to moment as if it was a dream. And it really expands consciousness. It's like our eyes become a wide angle lens suddenly. And we begin to see things that that, you know, previously we just didn't deem important. Suddenly the world itself becomes alive. There's a sense of this sort of subtle quivering energy behind all things. We don't necessarily need to know what it means, but we begin to know that it is meaningful. I think this is an important piece of dream work, by the way. Mm-hmm. There's so much emphasis on dream interpretation today, and I've spent, you know, 30 years doing dream interpretation in my work, so I believe it's interesting and useful, but I've come to a place where I really think that knowing what a particular dream means is not nearly as important as knowing that dreaming itself is meaningful. Mm-hmm. We're just not going to get it all. We're not going to grasp and understand all the mystery, but we can reinstate a relationship with that mystery. And there's something beautiful about that. It's kind of a return to the garden. It returns, as I said earlier, it re-enchants our daily lives. So we can practice this waking dream awareness during the day, and at night we can practice lucidity. They're simple techniques. One of them is putting up little, one that I like, you put up little post-it notes here and there, places that you'll see during the day on the bathroom mirror, maybe your refrigerator, maybe the rearview mirror of your car. And on that post-it note, you write a simple question. Am I awake? Or am I dreaming? Am I awake or am I dreaming? And you notice that, and it becomes part of the background of your life. Sooner or later, in a dream, that note will pop up. And when you see that, you'll recognize that you're dreaming while you're in the dream. So it's a way of practicing lucidity. There are lots and lots of little tricks like this. And again, when I encourage people to become lucid, I strongly encourage them not to manipulate the dream, but just to observe the dream and observe themselves as the dreamer. And this is part of the beauty. What you're doing there is you're deepening an awareness. You're deepening the relationship with your own self. And I think that's really where the juice is.
And so in lucid dreaming, is there a time within the night or during, well, actually you could do it any time, but is there a time that it's more likely, like in the last third, or is it best to try to have the lucidity at the beginning when you're going to sleep, or is there a time frame that's generally a good time for this?
Well, I don't know that there's a better time. I think the probability of lucidity arises. It increases as we get closer and closer to awakening for a number of reasons. One is that we're dreaming longer, and in one sense we're dreaming deeper at those times. And two is that we are gradually drifting back into waking consciousness. So there's a greater element of waking present. But I don't particularly think the timing is that important. And the practice can be very, very wonderful. I think at a level beyond interpretation, again, just we grow to develop a relationship with the dreamer, in one sense the creator within ourselves.
That's really beautiful. Now, I understand that you really like the Tibetan methods of doing this. Is there a book or one of your books that explains the Tibetan methods?
Yeah, well, there are a number of books out on Tibetan sleep and dream yogas. You know, unless somebody has been practicing for a long time, they might want to go easy on those. My first book has a couple of chapters on dreaming, including a chapter on the waking dream, which if this is a new process for people, I think that's a good starting point. That book is called Healing Night, The Science and Spirit of Sleeping, Dreaming, and Awakening. The Yoga of Sleep CD, a double audiobook CD set, I think is also very useful for that, in that it helps people really completely reimagine the consciousness context of all this work. As I said earlier, dream work, I really believe dream work can't be separated from sleep and waking, that these three seemingly discrete, independent kinds of consciousness need to be recognized as let's say, three sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like the trilogy, in a way. They're all interconnected.
It's all interconnected, exactly.
So what do you suggest when you're doing your dream work and you know there's, like, issues that you want to deal with? How do you suggest, is it more doing it through a meditative kind of dream work? Do you have suggestions if there's things that people, like I did with the anger, are there techniques or methods that you feel would help people to get to that point? Or is it just like reading your book and the yoga of sleep? Would that start the process so people can truly start healing themselves? Because what I am intuitively getting is people need to heal themselves. They're going to a lot of doctors and stuff, but all the answers are inside. So somebody might assist them in the process, but the more they're conscious of themselves and their issues and really connecting to their heart, the deeper self, the more they're going to know, okay, these are my triggers and I need to realize and work these through. For me, dream meditation has always been my preference and working on those. I kind of like innately knew how to deal with it. But do you have any methods or techniques or suggestions for people who are coming to that point?
Well, many. Yeah. You know, the Yoga of Sleep CD, as I said, it's a double CD set. The second CD includes five practices or sets of exercises. And they focus, of course, on the relationship between waking and sleeping and dreaming consciousness. But the impact of these practices absolutely is powerful on daily waking life as well. And the practices vary. One of them is focused on what I call the nightstand. And, you know, the nightstand, of course, for most of us is a piece of furniture next to our bed. That piece of furniture is incredibly revealing. And I have people do kind of an observational meditation of their nightstand, because not only is their nightstand a piece of furniture, but their nightstand is their psychological and spiritual posture toward night. You can tell a whole lot about what you believe about sleeping and dreaming by looking at the nightstand. So there's a whole set of practices around that. There's also a very unique practice on the Yoga of Sleep audiobook, and it's called writing your own bedtime story. Whether people read bedtime stories or think about bedtime stories, I believe everybody goes to bed at night, usually unconsciously, with a bedtime story about that day. We've finished the day. You know, there's an interesting parallel between falling asleep and dying. The Dalai Lama actually says in Tibetan Buddhism, the belief is that the psycho-spiritual experience of dying is identical to the psycho-spiritual experience of falling asleep. So there's an end of the day. There's kind of a metaphoric end of life that happens. And you know how this idea that our whole lives flash before us as we die. I think for most people unconsciously, the life of that day flashes before your eyes. So this exercise, this practice, is about making the construction of your bedtime story conscious. And as I've been hinting, I think so many of us get caught up in the mundane, we get trapped in all the meaningless details of daily life, and, you know, we lose sight of the forest for the trees. So this exercise helps you look at your day and essentially rewrite the story so that it fits into a much more heroic or adventurous, even a mythic story of your life. This is re-enchantment. I think that process is really helpful, both in letting go of the day and then in surrendering both to sleep and to dreams. And then I have some specific exercises, again, in both of these generalize to waking consciousness. One of them is about the process of surrendering, and that's much more of a guided meditation or visualization. It's literally a practice in letting go and surrendering. And then the last practice on that set is about mindful morning awakening. The way, again, if we're thinking in terms of this transition, this boundary between different states of consciousness, most of us go to sleep unconsciously at night, and we wake up even less consciously. Waking up is an incredibly sacred process. If falling asleep is a kind of dying, awakening in the morning is absolutely a kind of rebirth. And for most of us, that awakening is as mundane as it can get. You know, there's a screeching alarm that goes off. Most people, by the way, if you consistently awaken with an alarm, you're never getting enough sleep because it's just cutting your sleep short. It'd be like setting a timer when you sit down to eat a meal and giving yourself, you know, 7.5 minutes to eat. The timer goes off and you're done eating whether you like it or not. So most of us cut our sleep short. Awakening with an alarm it also, by the way, cuts our dreaming very short because we awaken from dreams and not sleep. So this last practice is about teaching people a new way to wake up in the morning, and it's a way of coming to waking consciousness without slamming the door behind us, without cutting off the serenity of sleep that's so palpable in the morning, and also the expansive consciousness of dreaming that we're just emerging from. I think that's very important. Rumi has a beautiful poem about awakening that I think captures this. It's called "Don't Go Back to Sleep." Now he uses the word sleep there, I think, to refer to an unconscious way of being awake. But he talks about the door being round and open, this passageway that we come through when we're coming out of the world of sleep and dreams into the world of waking. It's a beautiful invitation to stay conscious. And that's essentially what this last exercise on the CD is about. So all of those are really designed to create experiences. I mean, we're talking about this and these ideas are important, but of course words simply point. The truth is the experience itself, and the second CD in the Yoga Sleep Set is designed to give people direct experiences of what we've been talking about.
So with, it sounds like, and what I'm getting very strongly is the last one on the CD would actually kind of help you remember your dreams.
Helps remembering your dreams, and it helps you just stay connected. Most of us think that waking up is about discarding, you know, disconnecting from sleep and from dreaming, which is basically disconnecting from a sense of serenity and a sense of expansive consciousness, respectively. So we want to carry those. You know, I think, you know, the yoga sleep is about a unified consciousness. Ultimately, the word yoga is about unity. It's about the sense of oneness, which is our spirituality and connectedness. And all of this is about practicing, essentially not disconnecting, not segregating, waking from sleeping, from dreaming, allowing them to be as they are in nature, one unified experience.
And for me, it's always been a beautiful experience to consciously realize the connection. So I feel very blessed in when I have those really very lucid moments of feeling and being a part of everything. So I really do think and agree with you that dreaming is really important. We're almost done, but I want to ask one more quick question. And that's prophecy, that people have dreams of things that are going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just when they are connecting
with
the...
Very, very common. I frequently ask when I'm speaking to audiences around the country, how many people have had precognitive or prophetic dreams, and it's always surprising. Typically, more than half of the hands go up. So, you know, it's not an uncommon experience. What's your question about it?
Well, I'm just wondering. Well, I'm not kind of surprised that it actually. I feel like it's going to be increasing. But has there been proven a reason why some people are having it, or are they just getting in touch with the mass consciousness, the oneness, and are able to go forward in time within their dreamscape?
Well, it gets a little confusing.
Okay.
I I really have a deep respect for Eckhart Tolle's work, you know, his notion of the power of now. And I think when we shift into dream consciousness, we shift out of waking consciousness where we're embedded, most of us, in linear time. And, you know, it's only from a waking consciousness perspective that that's strange. You know, in the dream, by the way, all kinds of weird things happen in the dream. You know, you can see, you know, these gigantic green ducks, you know, working on a skyscraper. And, you know, when you're in the dream and you see that, it's really interesting. You think nothing of it. You think, oh, look at those green ducks. They're building a skyscraper. When you wake up and remember the dream from the vantage point of ordinary waking consciousness, people go, oh, my God, that was weird. But it wasn't weird when you experienced it. Mm-hmm. Likewise, when we experience, you know, something in a dream that then happens later, it, you know, only from the waking world perspective where we expect that things will be lined up sequentially in sort of a linear time fashion does that become weird. In the dream, there's no linear time. In a dream, you can be in the present. You can be in the future, and the next second you can be in the past. You can go back a century.
Right.
There is no time in the dream.
I
think dreaming takes us to a deeper reality. And the question, you know, the surprise of like, oh, my God, it's so strange that we had a prophetic dream. That's only from the limited perspective of waking. From the expansive perspective of dreaming, you can move back and forth in time.
Very much so. And with that, I thank you. What is the best way for people to find your work? Is it on soundtrue.com, or you definitely have a website that has some information?
Yes, there's a lot of information on my website, and you can also access books and CDs. My website is www.drnaiman.com. Actually, if you simply Google Rubin and Sleep, R-U-B-I-N, and the word sleep, you'll find a lot of my work linked there. So, yeah, and the CD is coming out, I think, any day. It is for sale already. You can access that, again, through my website or through the Sounds True website. It will be in bookstores and Whole Foods and places like that around the country very soon. So, yeah, it's all out there.
And
thank you very much. This was a great fun. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate your work. And actually, everything that they're doing down at the U of A is also really phenomenal, to really kind of mainstream alternative thinking in medicine. So I thank you for your work. Many blessings to you. It's been a real honor to speak with you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And with that, this is Jennifer Hellman saying, with each breath of air, we hope you gain new insights and inspirations. Until next time, many blessings and good night.